Hello, I'm Rob, and this is The Right Podcast, where I examine the far right in the U.S. and abroad, populist movements, syncretic politics, and the left from a leftist perspective. This episode is about my new Substack article, When Politics Forgets the Face, What Happens When Political Conviction Replaces Human Connection. It's a philosophical piece, but it's also a bit personal. It asks how we lose the ability to listen, especially when it comes to people outside of our own borders, and more broadly, what does that mean for solidarity? If you followed my work, you'll notice that this and my previous article in defense of leftist self-critique take a more reflective turn. Most of my earlier videos were research heavy, some a few hours long. But after asking what's happened, I reached the point of beginning to ask, why is this happening? And while in this case, I focus on the left, from the left, this could really be applied to anyone. That question of why first came up while researching the far right. And in that research, you know, it led me to some groups in Eastern Europe. And from there, I began seeing some misinformation about Ukraine on social media from both the right and left-wing accounts. I have experience with Ukrainian history. It's not my focus, but I worked at, in a historical society that had a Ukrainian group. I was a docent for exhibits, worked in their archives a bit, and became familiar with first-generation families. So I could tell much of what circulated online was just wrong, and not wrong in a subjective way or an opinion way, but just factually incorrect. Or, and this was more so the case, that what was being presented was lacking so much context or had so many fallacies or lies of omission or bias that if there were any kernels of truth, they were essentially meaningless as being presented. What shocked me was where this was coming from, though. It wasn't just the right, but it was also coming from parts of the left. And they were really, in many ways, repeating similar narratives in certain cases. And, you know, it wasn't just the fringe corners of the internet. I think most people know about groups like the Gray Zone, right? A well-known hub of disinformation. And that's not me saying it. That's what their Wikipedia page says about them. You know, these were coming from fairly respected thought leaders, or if not respected broadly, at least important people on the left, you know, for instance, someone like Noam Chomsky. And it also transcended the internet and thought leaders into real life. People that, I mean, sometimes people I grew up with, people I've known for decades have consistently been on what I think is the correct side. And all of a sudden, saying things that I didn't just disagree with based on principle, but that were just historically not accurate. That realization opened a broader question about how ideology, regardless of where it is on the political spectrum, can disconnect us from the people that our politics claim to serve. Or deeper questions about whether claiming to serve people is really the actual goal, right? Is being in solidarity with others the goal at all, or do we have ulterior motives? And, you know, regarding some of the things I heard, the responses really boil down to simplistic depictions, fallacies, things like, you know, if you give Ukrainians a platform, you're pro-war, or if you acknowledge the realities of Russian imperialism, you're somehow defending Democrats, or if you recognize basic historical fact, you're simping for empire. And it really, you know, looked similar to comment sections that you would find under, you know, a CNN post on Facebook or an MSNBC or Fox News post. It looked like kind of boomers yelling at each other in a way. And it was surprising that it was coming in different parts of the internet, in real life, and from people I just wouldn't necessarily expect. So, you know, of course, when I say it's like people yelling at each other, you know, they worded these things differently. And for many people, what they were saying fit a particular internal logic. But from outside, that logic was absent. And I think that that's important to recognize. You know, we can build operational structures or cognitive mechanisms that function coherently within a system. The gears are moving. Everything seems lined up and logical, yet this can appear entirely senseless from outside of it. And before I got deeper into philosophical questions, I noticed a surface level problem, a simpler problem that I think, you know, a lot of people who have even lightly engaged with activism or politics in the West would understand. And it really doesn't have a whole bunch of theory behind it. It's kind of a double standard based around what we would usually call something like allyship. And at least in the US, conversations about race, gender, LGBTQ issues, at some point they include the concept of being an ally or allyship and what that means. And basically it's centering those most affected, right? So for instance, I'm a white guy and I wouldn't walk into a discussion on policing and tell African-American folks, you know, how they should be talking about systemic racism in relation to policing. It's just not my place. I might have things to add. I might have scholarly information, but I'm not about to go up there and begin lecturing everybody on what I know that and how they should be acting. And, you know, in a similar way, I wouldn't do that to a convention at, you know, a university or something about feminism. I'm not about to go up and on a podium and tell feminists how they should be conducting their feminism. Yet, when the topic shifts to other countries or global topics, you know, Gaza, Ukraine, Syria, really anywhere, it seems like it's suddenly acceptable for Western voices to dominate those conversations. Why do we abandon that same principle when it happens internationally? Why do we turn to Western thought leaders, quoting each other self-referentially, and instead of listening to people that are from those regions? Well, you know, I think at one point in time, it was hard to hear those people or those folks didn't have a platform, but that's no longer the case. Not with technology that we have, not with social media, not with apps, not with the internet and YouTube. So, you know, I kind of think that that argument is outdated. Instead, I think some of it stems from the concept of abstraction, right? From using global suffering to make a point, not about the global suffering, but about the United States. Critiquing the West becomes more important in some of these discussions and hearing those actually caught in the war or tyranny happening. And that's what led me to this larger question. What happens when politics forgets the face of the person it's supposedly fighting for? That question also shaped aspects of my previous article, In Defense of Leftist Self-Critique, because before we can talk about other people, right, an encounter with other people or recognition or another face, right, first we have to make sure that there's space for self-examination. If we can't even question ourselves or question our own movements, then, you know, who are we to ask the right questions of others or allow others to question us? And so that's why this is kind of a break in these past two articles from what I had done previously and where I'm going. Answering that question, what it means to forget the face of somebody else, the other, who the politics is supposed to represent, is especially difficult for those of us inside empire, particularly the United States. But, you know, when I say empire, I don't just mean hegemony or military reach or foreign policy. I mean, also a system of perception, an inherited way of seeing the world through power. Even our attempts to help can carry the same hierarchy inside of them. Even when we try to help, we can reproduce many of the similar logics of empire itself. As Marcuse pointed out, our movements can mirror the very society that we're critiquing. We were socialized from within it, and we can carry some of that baggage along even with good intent. Many of these efforts, I think, begin with a genuine sense of empathy. You know, people will say, I'm an empath, right? I critique the West because I care about other people. And if you would care, you would too. And there's truth in that. But, you know, empathy expressed through political abstraction can end up marginalizing the very people it claims to defend. This is especially true when their words complicate the narratives used to advance our own critiques, even those of the West. Abstraction offers coherence. And I think that that's really important, right? It gives a sense of safety and order. Yet that comfort can come at the expense of truly facing the other in a genuine encounter. Inherent in that interaction is a possibility that the other might change you, or possibly, more unsettling for some, show that your internal coherence isn't as solid as you thought. With that, certainty goes out the window, and all of a sudden, we're not so comfortable anymore. There's also, I think, a psychological comfort, speaking of that, in abstraction, right? It protects us, and sometimes, not for everybody, but I think for some folks, our identities, right? It certainly protects certainty. Now, you know, we could get real deep and talk about certainty and in an uncertain universe, perhaps even its relationship to mortality and the great unknown. But, you know, I think reining it in a bit for this conversation, it at least gives a sense of belonging, right? A place, a tribe. Admitting uncertainty can feel like exile, if not an existential crisis. And that's why people cling to ideological coherence. It's not just belief, but it's also safety. That's what led me back to philosophy, and especially to Emmanuel Levinas. Now, I don't come from a philosophical background. I've read philosophy, but you know, mine is more historical and political. But Levinas helped me see this problem from a different and very interesting perspective. And despite his own contradictions, including his writings on Zionism, and in a way, those are actually useful, and I'll speak about those more in the future. He raised a vital point that ethics begins with the encounter, with recognizing the face of another person or the other before any ideology, analysis, or theory is applied. The moment we stop meeting people as people and start turning them into ideas, when we break that encounter into abstraction, we lose sight of what politics is for. In fact, we can even, maybe unintentionally, invert the relationship, making people into a means to our ideological ends. And this is what I mean by internalizing power, right? We come from empire, we're socialized from within it. Sometimes even in our right actions, we end up with negative results. And you know, that twist is especially alarming when our ideas are done with the intent of analyzing how power abuses these very people. And while that encounter still exists in some domestic politics, you know, talking about the concept of being an ally, it's largely missing when we talk about international concepts. So Levinas' idea of the face. So it's not just about empathy, although it involves that, or sentimentality. It's more about responsibility, right? The face of another person makes a demand on us before any system or ideology becomes involved, right? No abstraction. It interrupts that certainty of abstraction, as a matter of fact. It reminds us that ethics begins not in that theory and in that idea, but in the encounter itself with the other human. That's what I think is missing from some of today's political conversation, including that conversation on the left. I think, you know, we speak about liberation and solidarity, but we often do so from within structures of comfort, academia, on the internet, from ideological protections that filter out the people we claim to stand with. And, you know, we relate to categories and sometimes even identify as with those categories instead of to the human beings that are involved. And you can see this in a non-political sense. Anytime a tragedy occurs online, there's a major earthquake somewhere, let's say, and, you know, so no one caused this earthquake, but the discussion quickly shifts from the people involved to what their suffering proves about someone else's politics. And this becomes clear when we begin looking at international political issues that the same people who would never presume to speak for African Americans or women or queer communities or what have you at home, you know, seem to have less issue speaking on behalf of Syrians or people in Gaza or Ukrainians abroad. Instead of centering those most affected, we sometimes replace their voices with Western frameworks that make sense to us, even in critique of the West. And once those frameworks harden into conviction or identity or a safety mechanism, maybe in coherence, the people themselves can disappear, or even worse, that interaction with them may contradict aspects of that conviction. And to maintain that internal coherence that makes sense from the inside, maybe not so much from the outside, those folks can be vilified or made into things like Western agents and conspiracies and what have you. And that's what it means for politics to forget the face. Solidarity, I don't think, in my opinion, is about abstraction, but instead relation. It means standing beside people, not to the right, left, above them, with them. And it means accepting uncertainty and complexity instead of fleeing to the safety of coherence. And, you know, it starts, as Levinas said, with that first encounter, with the face that resists being turned into an idea or abstraction, lost in an ideological totality. Now, the article goes much deeper into this and more about Levinas, but to put it simply, before politics or theory, there is that encounter. You have to have that encounter. And when you have that encounter, the face of the other inherently says to you, do not harm me. That is an ethical demand, and it comes before and outside of ideology. And because of that, it interrupts our self-certainty about things. It may seem paradoxical that those critiquing empire or the West could, in that act, reproduce harm, yet if we refuse to hear other people because their experiences complicate our worldview, or worse, we vilify them or tie them into some pre-existing conspiracy narrative, that's exactly what happens. We erase their face, and with it, any possibility of relation. And without relation, there is no solidarity. Judith Butler took these ideas a bit further, asking who gets to appear as a face at all, right? Whose lives are seen as grievable? And she expanded Levinas's framework, grounding it in a broader political and ethical question. For Levinas, yeah, I think we need to recognize with his faults that he was Jewish and he fought in World War II and he spent time as a prisoner of war under Nazism. So, you know, his philosophy isn't as abstract as I think some people make it. It was really born from material confrontation with fascism, but somewhat specific to his personal experience. And because of that, maybe limited. But even attempts to universalize his ideas can negatively flatten them. Extending ethics to everyone, like Butler's project, is important, but when universality ignores history and material differences, it risks becoming another abstraction. This is particularly true of people and regions impacted by colonialism, right? That universalization can take on aspects of a colonial mindset. For colonized or racialized people, the promise of this, you know, universal can come through exclusion or assimilation into Western subjecthood. And I think that's where Franz Fanon becomes important, because Fanon not only approached these questions from a materialist perspective, but from within the colonial world itself, or at least the colonial world's perspective. And his experience revealed how domination doesn't just silence the other, it produces non-relation as a structure. And that structure was something that was missing, for lack of a better word, from those earlier assessments. And Fanon reveals something that Levinas really couldn't. And it was that under colonialism, the ethical failure becomes structural. For Levinas, forgetting the face is a refusal of responsibility in ethics. But for Fanon, colonialism doesn't just ignore the face, it annihilates the very possibility of that relation existing, right? The colonized are not misrecognized subjects, but objects within a total system of dehumanization. In other words, he adds a material analysis that describes structures of power beyond simply ourselves. And I think that in the West, sometimes we approach these issues through a kind of unconscious materialism. For some people, it's at the forefront. But I think that, you know, we inherited maybe a legacy of analyzing structures, power, and capital without even realizing what we're doing. And there's nothing wrong with that. That needs to happen. But, you know, the problem is that material analysis, when detached from ethics, can turn into abstraction or forgetting the face of the other. And in all fairness, the inverse can also be true. Ethics without material grounding risks becoming moral idealism, right? Something that's not really actionable or only addresses interpersonal relationships. And you could argue that these are incompatible systems at odds with each other, contradicting one another. And I bet if you repeated that to an adherent of either of these, they'd firmly disagree with the depictions that I gave. But instead of seeing them at odds, I see a kind of yin and yang tension between the two. Ethics without change can become abstraction. Material change without ethics can become a form of domination. Levinas shows the responsibility precedes knowledge, that before theory there is the encounter, while Fenon shows that systems and structures can destroy even the capacity for that encounter to occur in the first place. And applied to contemporary politics, this tension, this kind of yin and yang, helps explain a paradox we see in discussions of things like Ukraine or Syria, right? Those claiming to oppose empire ending up defending regional empires, right? Ending up defending Assad in some way, or the Russian military or Putin in some way, reproducing similar hierarchies that they claim to be resisting against the West. And, you know, their politics become non-relational, guided not by responsibility to the people involved, but by loyalty to abstractions, whether they label them politics, philosophy, science, social science, history, you know, what have you. It's long, they're functioning in a very similar way. And in reviewing all this, I think that the idea of relational politics comes to the forefront. Every political moment eventually confronts a limit, a point where explanation can't replace encounter. That's where ethics either collapses into ideology and abstraction or becomes something living again. It begins with the awareness that no moment and no movement stands apart from the people it claims to serve. Reflection, then, isn't betrayal. It's fidelity to this responsibility. And this is why, before we can even talk about these concepts of the other, we need to be able to be critical of ourselves and our movements. Non-relational politics offers distance, and that distance often comes through abstraction, which provides a sense of certainty. It lets us stay safe within our framework. So it's almost as if we're mimicking a scientific perspective. Relational politics does the opposite. It invites transformation. To listen in the first place is to risk being changed, possibly by the very people that we thought we were helping in the first place. So in the past, if I've been accused of being partisan, right, simply by amplifying voices of those living through war or occupation when they contradict thought leaders or trending ideas or ideologies, it reminded me that relation is very much a threat to ideology itself. Hearing directly from others destabilizes the narratives that we build around them for them. But, you know, that's what makes it necessary in the first place, to destabilize that. Now, material analysis is still crucial. Look, any self-respecting socialist or leftist or would probably walk away from any conversation that would suggest otherwise. And we can't abandon structure or power. But if analysis isn't grounded in relation, it risks becoming domination in another form. And there is something of a chicken or egg scenario playing out in that, if we're looking at philosophically. But, you know, instead of worrying about the sequence, you know, I think it could be viewed as relational, or again, like a yin and yang, as opposed to confrontational or consecutive. But regardless of those discussions, at some point, we all have to decide, are we acting upon the world? Are we forcing ourselves upon the world, or are we working with the world? Are we speaking for people or with them? Are we trying to be right or be in relation and solidarity with others? What are we doing? Okay. That's where politics begins again, not in certainty, but an encounter and the possibility of being uncertain. Both when politics forgets the face and in defense of leftist self-critique share the same impulse to make space for humility again, right? So self-critique is not self-sabotage. It's what keeps conviction from turning into dogma, right? From putting people on pedestals. Relational politics grows from that same soil. It asks us to replace our certainty or loyalty with responsibility and our ideologies with the encounter. The challenge ahead isn't necessarily to choose size, but to choose relation, to build a politics that remembers the face and acts with the world instead of merely upon it. Maybe that's the work of our time right now, not to reinvent politics or come up with something new, but to remember what it was supposed to be in the first place, a way of meeting each other in all of our fragility and finding solidarity in that shared condition, as that shared condition has existed throughout history. So I'm stopping here. If it seems like I'm being a bit abrupt, well, you're right, because I want you to go read the article to get the rest. I very much appreciate you for listening, and especially if you've been someone who's been listening through the past year or year and a half or so. If you want to read the full article, it's linked below. And if this conversation resonates, share it. And you don't need to agree with it. You can trash it, say how horrible of an idea this is, but at least do so as an invitation to reflect with other people together on it. For other content, visit therightpodcast.org, where all of my articles, whether they're Substacks or in academic journals or opinion pieces are located. A back catalog of podcasts and videos can also be found there, and the link will be below. Thanks for listening.